Hello, and welcome to the Back Issue Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayer.
In this episode, we'll be having a spoiler-filled discussion about an older comic book storyline.
Spotlight, I am joined by Sam, and we are going to be discussing the Stark Wars arc from Iron Man 225 to 232, which was published in, from December 1987 to July 1988, or at least those are the dates they had in the comics. These are also collected in the Iron Man Epic Collection, Volume 13, Stark Wars. I think it's like the last half of that collection.
Yep.
How are you doing tonight, Sam?
I am wonderful.
Cool. Now, I was reading this stuff as it was coming out, and this was shortly after James Rhodes stopped being Iron Man, and I had started reading Iron Man when he was there, because I had gotten on a lot of this stuff around the time of Secret Wars, the original, and I don't know that I have reread these things since then, and I gotta say, it was a non-trivial amount of reading.
Well, yeah, I was shocked. We're starting with issue 225. I was shocked. It felt like I'm like, wow, that I'm reading and I'm reading. As it turns out, it was a double size issue, I guess.
Yeah, it was about 40 pages.
Yeah. And Bob Layton and Dave Michelinie tend to be pretty wordy.
Mm-hmm.
This is before I started reading Iron Man regularly. So I think I first read this when the Epic Collection came out. So probably 4 or 5 years ago was the first time I read it.
Yeah, well, we did 8 issues of this, which was, you know, a little bit... I knew it was a lot to bite off, but I hadn't realized the first was double-sized, so yeah. And I really hadn't factored in... I was kind of sort of aware of it, but just hadn't factored in. This is all in that 1980s era storytelling style.
Absolutely.
I mean, you get full episodic stories per issue, and they're part of an ongoing arc over the course of the issues.
Yep.
So, man, there is just a ton of stuff going on in these things, but it makes for a fairly good read because, I mean, you come out of this having covered, you know, over half a year's worth of the Iron Man stuff at that point, and it is just such a different storytelling style. I'm sure I'm sounding like a broken record on this, but anyone who hasn't read stuff from this era has got to find something they'd enjoy from this period and dig in to about, you know, 6 to 9 issues of something and compare it to the modern storytelling style. And that's not to say the modern is bad and the old is good or anything of the sort. They're just so different.
They are definitely vastly different.
It was just shocking to me how much happened, and particularly just with that first issue, which, again, was double-sized, but, you know, it starts with, you know, a quick practice run of, you know, Tony using the armor for the army just to show off what it can do and stuff, and, you know, he's examining this other armor he'd gotten from a guy from a few issues back, and, oh, geez, it's powered by Tony's technology, and he can't have that, because he's still feeling guilt over, you know, being an arms producer or whatever, and, you know, just kicking off the whole he's going to go after this stuff, and we get a recap of his history, we get some stuff setting up Scott Lang getting pulled into the story, and just the references to some recent issues, you know, with Spymaster, again with Force, whose armor he's got. I mean, all of that was just some of what happened in this issue, you know? Because he's also, it's like, well, I gotta track these things, I've gotta go figure out how to nullify this technology, and he actually goes after, what was it, Mauler or whatever in this one. And this is something that this issue in and of itself would have been a story arc or two today.
Oh, absolutely.
It was just, it was a good read, but it's like, wow, there's so much here.
Yeah.
And I would say, while there have been a lot of big arcs for Iron Man, this is probably the one of this era that has had ramifications that last to this day.
Certainly, it's a theme that modern writers have liked to go back to, that's for sure.
I wasn't even thinking the actual Armor Wars part of it itself, but his relationship with Steve, Captain America.
Yeah. Yep.
Fundamentally changed in this arc.
Yep.
And I think that eventually set the seeds for civil war and things of that sort. So there's a lot of things that, I mean, there are certain things that are just hallmarks of Iron Man stuff.
Oh, yeah.
To your point of you know, various armor wars over the years of other people using his tech, yeah, that's an easy go-to kind of story for him. You know, we get new armor in this, which, again, a go-to story arc for Tony. It's like, let's build the new armor. But it's just, it was interesting when we got the list of people who might have been using his tech. And it's just a checklist of all of the you know, villainous armored people from the Beetle, Shockwave, Dr. Doom. And I'm like, okay, wait a sec. Doom's not using Tony's tech. I'm sorry. I don't buy that.
Well, especially, theoretically, Doom's mask. And doesn't that stuff predate Tony?
I would have to check some sort of a timeline.
Fair enough.
To know what was supposed to happen when. Because I don't know. I mean, obviously, it would have predated the level of tech that was stolen here, because it seemed to be fairly current-ish stuff versus, you know, the armor he'd put together back in his origin. You know, if that was stolen, it's like, okay, now, you know, Doom maybe. But even then, Doom's too arrogant to use somebody else's technology. I didn't buy that. But I thought this was a fun concept. Again, not a new, well, I was not going to say not a new one. It was new then. But to end the issue with him, it's like, I'm going to do this whether the law's on my side or not. You know, again, kind of sets a threshold that he's willing to, you know, both bend and break the law if he needs to.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And that was a recurring theme in this arc.
Yes.
You know, the level of regrets he kind of chalks up here is pretty lengthy.
Yeah, and I think one of the more interesting sequences in here is the late night phone call,
mm-hmm.
where he's, you know, and again, when you're dealing with military personnel and the idea, you know, I kind of want to be left alone. Why are we bringing this up, particularly in the middle of the night? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's, he doesn't have a lot of regard for potentially the feelings of others here either.
No. But,
you aren't all bad people.
Yeah, yeah. I think there's an aspect of Tony Stark, particularly in this era, that Tony does what Tony wants because, well, he's Tony, you know?
Yeah.
Other people's feelings and stuff, not always on his radar.
Yeah.
You know? And that was something that, you know, when he's pulling in, like, Ant-Man and stuff to basically go do a heist and stuff, and he's like, well, I got lawyers. What's the worst that could happen?
Yeah. And Rhodey seemingly tries to keep him sort of grounded without just abandoning him.
Rhodey, I think, always has to act as Tony's conscience because Tony doesn't always have one.
Exactly.
And this was not all that long after Rhodey kind of traumatically stopped being Iron Man.
Yeah.
So there's a little bit of not wanting to get back in the suit himself. The relationship between those two is always kind of interesting, and I think at this point, Rhodey was very much a loyal employee/follower or whatever of Tony, even though he had his reservations, and he'd seen Tony at his worst, you know, because Tony was drunk, which is what prompted Rhodes to take over the armor at one point.
Yep.
So I always thought that era of Iron Man, which again is just a year or so before this, was some fun stuff.
Yeah.
But this whole bit of, you know, going after, like, Stiltman and some stuff like that and whatnot, and, you know, encountering the controller and stuff. It's just, it was crazy how much was happening just so quickly in this.
Yeah, well, the Stiltman sequence in this issue in particular felt, hey, we need to put some action in here, because there's a lot of just talking and writing and plotting, and there's a lot of office scenes.
Mm-hmm.
That, I don't want to say it was, while it certainly adds to character development, it didn't feel vital to this plot. It was like, well, we better put in at least a page or two of action.
I definitely think it was to balance, like you said, all of the talking heads and whatnot going on. But in the span of this issue, I mean, he goes up, we get a fair number of action sequences, even if they're a little arguably gratuitous.
Fair enough.
But the fact that he went up against the controller, Stiltman, Mahler, sort of, you know, in the span of an issue after we've had the heist and, you know, the gratuitous action, you know, with the army and stuff there at the beginning, that's a really full issue.
Yeah.
Even a double length, you know, today this would have, again, been its own arc at least. And this was all just to kick off the storyline.
Yes.
That's the part for me that's just so fundamentally different with, you know, different eras of storytelling.
Well, and I don't think Hammer's actually mentioned in this issue, except maybe at the very end. Is he?
I don't think he was at this point.
Yeah.
I think they were still trying
to figure it out.
No, I think Hammer was mentioned there at the end.
Was he?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, when he's talking to the lawyer. Okay, at the very, very end. Yeah. But again, not till the last page.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is a giant issue. So really, not in this issue, which is almost two issues anyways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I thought this got the story off to a good start. I liked how it was also picking up plot lines from recent issues. Again, the Armor Force War from a few issues back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kicking off this. That's how they get things that go from one to another to another to another and keep kind of that never-ending saga feel going.
Yes, without having to explicitly start the story over again and again and again without, you know, any, you know, without it coming across as, oh, you missed one, don't bother coming back for 6 months.
Yeah, well, there's an accessibility to the story.
Yes.
Even if you didn't catch the issue with this Force guy, it's like, oh, he had armor, Tony's looking at it because, well, he's Tony, he wants to play with the tech. Oh, that's where the story is moving from.
Yeah.
You know, we get a reference to Spymaster and stuff from a few issues back. It gives you the context to know what's going on. And because each issue is picking up threads from past story arcs, recent past story arcs, it feels like a cohesive narrative of the life of Tony Stark versus, okay, we ended a story, it's got a clean break, and this kind of picks up at some point afterwards. You know, it happens to have Tony Stark, but it doesn't feel like it's the one that we just saw last week, necessarily.
Yes, exactly.
And to me, that's an aspect of storytelling that I think just got dropped at one point.
Yeah.
I remember one period where Nightwing, it felt like every six-issue arc or so, he had a new creator, and they were dumping him in a new city with a new status quo. He's setting up a new base, and fresh start and all this stuff. And I'm like, okay, that's fine for the first one. Four or five times in, it's like, come on.
Exactly. And stories to me do not feel as cohesive.
Yeah.
And maybe that's not the right word, but I'm trying to think how to say that.
It doesn't feel like it's one saga that we're following.
Yes.
And that's, you know, it's not an easy thing to do.
Yeah.
But they did it well at this point in time.
Mm-hmm.
The next issue, we get Stingray is kind of the featured guy, but the Raiders at the beginning?
The Raiders. Yeah, I was going to say the Raiders. These guys are kind of fun.
I am not all that familiar with these guys. I mean, I read this when it came out, so I had obviously seen them before, because they're here. But I don't know how much use this group got over the years, and I went ahead and pulled out the official Handbook of the Marvel Universe Deluxe Edition. They didn't rate an entry.
Hmm.
As luck would have it, issue number 10 that they would have been in, because it was from Paladin to Rhino, dated September 86, so a year and a half, 2 years before this, actually had what the inclusion requirements were for entries. And this is Mark Ruhmold, and they had to be alive and of quote-unquote major importance. Appeared three times, once in the past or next year. You know, or they had to be unique and, you know, kind of add to the overall tapestry of the Marvel Universe. So this would have been far enough in the future they probably weren't planned to be used when they would have had their entry. And again, I don't know if they've been used since.
Yeah, I don't know that they've been used since. I did catch the reference to 145.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did go back and look that up at least.
I did not. What did they do then?
Boy, they were sent by Edwin Cord to basically steal some tech from Tony at a convention.
Ah, so again, tech thieves, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's who had hired them here, it seemed like.
Yeah.
Because we get Edwin Cord and kind of a tease of this Project Firepower. You know, like, well, I bet that's an upcoming plot line of some sort. And sure enough, it was. The look of these guys, the Raiders, is kind of interesting.
Yeah, it's unique, it's different, you know, very 70s, 80s, but I think it's kind of cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was fun. Get some good action sequences, you know, as they're flying around and whatnot. And then also, at some point in this issue, we get a quick recap of just a panel or two of, you know, Tony's hunting down people who've stolen his technology, etc. Mm-hmm. Just to where, if you missed the last issue, you've got an idea what's going on, which is kind of nice.
And then you get the kind of the decision, well, it's interesting. You get the decision to go after Stingray, and then mm-hmm. you kind of get the visit to the West Coast Avengers.
Yeah, they make a couple of cameos in this arc, and it's interesting how he's able to just, yeah, trust me. And they're like, okay.
Yeah.
And the fact, I mean, he was a key member of that team at this time, so they couldn't just ignore it. And I liked how they have that level of continuity across titles at this point. And that's a lot of what made the Marvel Universe feel so cohesive, is you spend a couple of panels, you got Tony talking to the West Coast Avengers that comes back later and stuff, and it's not like these things are so disconnected that they had no clue what was going on.
Yeah.
So, now Stingray is not one that gets a ton of use and such. He's been an Avengers from time to time, I think, manned one of their Hydro base or something like that. And this was one where it's like, you know, this isn't a bad guy, but it could be his tech, so gotta go check it out.
Yes.
Which kind of begged the question for me at this point of why Vindicator or Guardian, whichever would have been active at this point, wasn't on Tony's list. I mean, that stuff isn't based on Tony's tech, but, I mean, Tony wouldn't have known that. So, I think there were a few other people they could have brought into the story if they had wanted to, but it was busy enough as it was, I don't think they needed to.
Yeah. And then you get the big speech at the end,
mm-hmm.
which kind of is dramatic. It's a big cliffhanger, but kind of gets played out, but not exactly, when he fires Iron Man.
Yeah, that's one of those things that I think if it was done in a modern comic, what they would also go to is later on him getting somehow sued or in legal trouble for blatantly lying about that kind of thing.
Well, the other thing is... And again, this is a storytelling difference. My guess is if this issue or this story was to be printed today,
mm-hmm.
that wouldn't be a final page. It would be a first page, and then you'd get the second page, you know, 25 hours earlier.
Yeah.
Rather than the way it was done here.
Probably, but I think this was more effective.
I tend to agree with that, and I hate that other style, but
yeah, it's
the way it would probably be done today.
Yeah, I have an almost pathological hatred of the start at the exciting thing and then quickly roll back to set it all up.
Yeah.
It's like you don't have an otherwise good entrance to the story, so maybe work on the story a little more, guys.
Yeah.
So, yeah, when he was firing Iron Man, it's like, this is clearly an attempt to get the legal and PR pressure off Stark Enterprises. I mean,
yeah.
But since nobody knows who Iron Man is at this point, he can get away with it. Clearly not something that could have happened in the MCU continuity, where Tony was very upfront that he was Iron Man.
Yep.
So, given how the story had started on he's going after the villains, for him to have spent this issue going after Stingray, and then the next issue going after the Mandroids, which are, you know, government agents and such, I'm like, okay, that's not where I was thinking the story was going to go, but still fun. What did you think of this opening party scene where he's going after the Beetle?
Beetle,
stuff?
Yeah.
And I'm thinking less about the Beetle than all the cameos we got.
Yeah, it's an interesting mix of... I'm not sure why it was done. I'm not sure.
Because I think we got Lionel Richie. Maybe that's Hulk Hogan next to him. On the next page, we definitely got Michael J. Fox.
And Don Johnson.
I thought it was Don Johnson. I wasn't sure.
It never happened in Miami. That's got to be Don Johnson.
That's what I had figured, too. Who's the one next to Michael J. Fox? Who, you know, the comment about ever made the cover of People?
I have no idea.
This is where not being in the 80s kind of, you know, gives us a disadvantage on this. So, I mean, cute little cameos and whatnot didn't really make any difference to the story and whatnot. You know, it's like, okay, fun to do, whatever. It does feel a little odd seeing this version of the Beetle, given how long we've had the female version kind of going around the more recent Marvel Universe.
And I haven't read anything more recently, so I'm not overly familiar with the Beetle at all, so this seemed normal to me.
Is the Beetle the one who then joined the Thunderbolts and became Mach 5 or something?
I believe Abner Jenkins became Mach X.
He went through a variety of Mach this, that, and the others.
Yeah, but that was the Thunderbolts. That was this Beetle, I believe.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. But, so,
yeah, again, where that's gone from since then, I have no idea.
Yeah, yeah. And he takes care of the Beetle pretty quick. The fact that he's been able to devise something to track his technology and another something to just negate it by tossing this electronic gizmo onto an armored suit. A little pseudoscience-y, but yeah, whatever, it works.
Yeah, but it's consistent, and they've been using it since, well, the first issue we covered today, so.
Yeah, it just seems like that should have taken a little longer to figure out. But he's a genius, so we'll give it to him. I gotta say, I love the house he's got at this point.
Well, and the weird, like, underground entrance and, yes.
Yeah, all that.
Yes. Which is very reminiscent of the house he has in the first film, possibly the first two films.
Yeah, it's definitely, I think the house was evocative of this one.
Yes.
From the movies. I think it's also the house they used in one of the Charlie's Angels films.
It's been used in, say, it's been used in one of the later Lethal Weapons. It's, I happen to know that particular home. I know where it is. It gets used quite a bit.
How long has that home been around, and could it have been the basis for this?
No. I believe it was constructed in the mid-90s.
So after this.
Yes.
So we do get another quick cameo of the West Coast Avengers.
Mm-hmm.
And they're, again, willing to take Tony as his word, which is nice. I think the part that struck me oddest about that was him taking the call in his underwear.
Okay.
I mean, he just gotten out of the armor and stuff, but it's like, okay.
Well, yeah, well, he comes in through the hatch, and you see him disrobing from the armor, and yeah, he just walks over and takes the call.
Yeah.
The part with Fury is the part I find a little uncharacteristic, at least for Nick.
Well, I thought it was nice to see Nick Fury and S.H.I.E.L.D. kind of checking in on Tony Stark, and
mm-hmm.
I think Fury, if he's really as good of a spy as he's supposed to be, and let's face it, he is, he should have already known who Iron Man was.
Well, yes.
So when he asks for the file and gets this Randall Pierce file and such, and then explains, well, he's a liability, I mean, I want the armor, you can have the guy.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of worked for me. I'm wondering if they've ever used the Randall Pierce identity later.
Huh. I have no idea.
I mean, it certainly seems like something that's ripe for doing stories based on. Whether it's Tony assuming the name or somebody else and claiming the identity and such. It could make for a very interesting case of identity theft in the Marvel Universe.
Absolutely. I don't know, Nick. But yeah, Nick seems, and one could argue this whole thing's theater and they both kind of know, but it doesn't seem like the way stories were told in those days.
I don't think it was theater in terms of, I don't think the events would have played out if Nick knew.
Exactly. Which, again, just seems out of character for Nick.
Yeah, yeah. I'd have to go back and do some research to find out if Nick should have known at this point. Because Tony was one of the ones in the first Nick Fury Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. stories, you know, who was supplying tech and stuff, but I think that was before he was Iron Man. But I'm not certain.
Yeah.
But all of this, just so he can get to the Mandroids and kind of disable them, was kind of interesting. I did not recognize this Ling McPherson that he goes and dates ever so briefly here.
Who seems to be a private eye, yeah. I'm not familiar with the character.
There's a mention of Beth, and I'm wondering if that was Bethany McCabe, who I think was Madame Mask
around
this time. I don't know. The cameo of Trump Tower was just kind of funny. But all of that was just, you know, so they could spend some time while they were waiting for being able to go up against the Mandroids.
Yep.
And the action sequences we get here, fun. You know, I don't recall how much the Mandroids were getting used around this point, but it was one of the many things that were just, you know, established parts of the Marvel Universe back then. And the whole bit of, you know, he knows he designed the stuff, it's not illegal tech, but he can't risk it getting in the wrong hands and such. You know, again, just shows kind of how obsessive Tony can be at this point.
Yeah.
It was interesting. I would have expected there to be a little bit more fallout of this later with Nick.
Absolutely.
Didn't really seem to be.
Yeah.
And the whole bit of, you know, how Tony kind of convinces S.H.I.E.L.D. they've been bugged and they were the leak.
Yeah.
Seems a little flimsy, but I can see that sort of a thing playing out with, you know, in the movie continuity too. I can see them selling that kind of concept. But the epilogue I thought was kind of fun, setting up the next issue with Steve Rogers coming back for a visit. Yeah.
Yep.
Because at this point, he'd been forced out as Captain America, and he was going as just the Captain in an outfit that later became used by a U.S. agent. And he's here looking for a shield. And yeah, this next issue, 228, this I think is a fundamental turning point in the relationship between Tony Stark and Steve Rogers.
It certainly feels like it should be. I don't know if it... I don't know how long it took for... With the benefit of hindsight now, it's easy to say that. I'm not sure 2 years later it was as obvious.
I think there was always a bit of a strain. I think there are times where the fracture that was created here got much worse.
Yes.
But it definitely sets up kind of the rift of these two know that there are going to be times they're on opposite sides of an issue. Now, I think there's a Captain America issue that's got this same basic scene or parts of it from Cap's point of view, and we get a little bit more about the shield.
Okay.
Because I recall somewhere that this one was made out of... Well, there's one that's made out of pure vibranium, but he may have gotten that from T'Challa, because he's gone through a couple of different shields. But this was definitely one of them when he was without his regular one, because he'd lost the job. And this is one where, again, to your point of they start somewhere and then roll back to set it back up. It's like, okay, they didn't roll too far back. I'll allow it this time, but yeah.
Well, and that whole Electro roadie thing is just weird.
On so many levels.
Yes.
What got me is, okay, Electro is in downtown Denver blasting away, and a couple of guardsmen go and capture him and stuff. It's like, oh, I didn't realize he'd broken out. Nobody told us he's escaped. It's like, and you don't even call to check?
Yeah.
Because presumably Electro's still in, you know, the vault or wherever. But for that to have been some tech that Tony whipped up in just a couple of days, and for it to be Rhodey in disguise, okay, that's, I really question how that would have played out today, what the reaction would have been.
Yeah.
Tony being able to make the tech, yeah, sure, I'll buy that and do it in a couple of days, whatever. But the fact that Electro's thrown into a jail that anyone can walk in or out of, but Electro's unique metabolism and stuff can't. That just seems like poor security. So, but it gives, you know, Rhodey, you know, free run of the place, so that works.
Well, yeah, and then you get that weird cat and mouse game with Steve and Rhodey and Tony and...
Yeah.
It's basically the rest of the issue at this point.
Yeah, the whole bit of... How some of this plays out's a little odd, but, you know, it works. And again, I don't know that these guys are seen after this or not.
Yeah, and it's weird because we did read some Cap issues around this era, which is why I think the very one-panel cameo from Mr. Hyde is so interesting. Because he did show up in those Cap stories from around this same era, when we covered that.
Well, they mentioned that this... plays out in Cap 339 with Titania and Mr. Hyde.
Is that one of the ones we covered? Or?
I don't think so.
Fair enough.
But off the top of my head, I don't recall, if you give me a sec.
I just remember the Cap stuff we covered, one of them had Mr. Hyde as kind of a focal point.
We did 247 to 252.
So way before this.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, it just happened to also be a Mr. Hyde story.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I didn't go check out that issue to go find out what was going on there.
Yeah, me neither.
But the guardsman, or the guardsman, was armor that Tony had originally put together, and then when Obadiah Stane took over one of Tony's companies, he mass-produced it for the government, which is why there's so many and why Tony's kind of going after it at this point. And again, if you've got places like the Vault, Project Pegasus, etc., having some dudes in some armor to protect the place does kind of make sense. So, I mean, I kind of get why Captain America was like, we need these guys. But I can also see where Tony's like, no, it's too much of a risk. But yeah, quite a bit of this issue was spent with them just kind of fighting back and forth and then Cap getting in the middle of it. And the way Tony kind of deals with Cap, I can definitely see Cap not being happy about that.
No, of course not. And they highlight it and point it out, and absolutely.
Yeah. Well, and this was a era of Marvel where some of these characters would do something and then spend the next issue agonizing over how they'd done it.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I have no problem with. I mean, there was an issue where Cap had to go fight some bad guys, didn't have his shield at hand at that point in the fight, picked up a machine gun and shot some of the guys. And it's the first time he'd shot anyone since, you know, back in the war. Spent the next issue agonizing over it and such. But I think these days, people would have flipped out so much on the first issue and not given a chance to read the repercussions of it.
Also probably true.
And I'm sure they did the same flipping out back then. It just took longer for the letters to reach the publisher and, you know, everyone else to get wind of it. I was not crazy about how this ended on a, you know, where are they kind of a moment, and that story goes off to Captain America versus continued here, but yeah, it's like fine.
But yeah, there, while the story continues, there's certainly a big jump and change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and, you know, they do recap it quickly in a couple of pages.
Yeah. What gets me is by 229, we're now over halfway through this arc.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, the West Coaster. Tony, what's up? Providing an excuse for the recap and stuff. But this is really, when he goes after the Titanium Man and Crimson Dynamo, kind of the first time he's going after, I don't want to say villains, because they're arguably heroes in that part of the world and such. But I was, again, that list we got at the beginning, I was expecting there to be more Stiltman, you know, and those Beetle, those type of people that Tony'd be going up against. I think they sold it one way and played out a little bit differently, but I was okay with it. It was a fun story.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I like I said, I enjoyed this story. I thought it fit perfectly. You know, and again, you were talking 3, 4, 6 months between these. They might not have, you know, here's a list of the types of people, and, you know, you didn't necessarily get to all of them. You added some. It doesn't seem like that big a deal.
Other than the fact that so far most of the people he's fought have not been villains at all.
No, almost none of them.
I mean, if it had just been different ones than the ones listed, fine.
Yeah.
But, you know, all these villains are doing evil with my technology, so I'm going to go after the government agents that have it first. That was the part that felt just a little weird. I was more familiar with Crimson Dynamo than the Titanium Man.
I don't know that I know the Titanium Man at all. Crimson Dynamo I was familiar with. That said, I think Titanium Man was a more interesting character in this particular issue.
I would agree with that entirely. Now, the Gremlin, is he tied into the Hulk's backstory?
I don't know.
Maybe not originally, maybe in a retcon. I'm not sure. He might be, he might not be.
Yeah.
But yeah, he was definitely a more interesting character here. Definitely had just more attitude versus kind of the patriot that Crimson Dynamo was. And then Tony kind of either dusting off or rebuilding the stealth armor. It was kind of fun. Because, again, at this point, he had an armor for almost every occasion. Which you would think in and of itself is a security risk, given he's worried about his technology getting loose, because he's got so much of it lying around. But then using that backpack kind of booster thing to get halfway around the world, kind of cool. I just enjoyed this issue. It was fun to see a different corner of the Marvel Universe, and Tony in a different set of armor, and having to deal with the limitations of that suit. I don't know that the stealth armor is necessarily the best looking of his armors.
No, it reminds me of Blue Beetle more than anything.
Yeah, I can see that. Particularly with the shade of blue it kind of is and stuff. Yeah,
and the odd jet thing. Yes.
Yeah. The trick he pulls later when he's fighting Titanium Man was kind of interesting, where it flips colors to white to blend into the snow.
Snow, yeah.
Makes me wonder if he could do other colors as well. I was a little surprised by kind of how things played out with Titanium Man. I didn't expect to see that.
Yeah, I didn't expect that either, and it's, again, treated very differently now here than it would be now.
Mm-hmm.
That would have been a major point now, both to the writer, most writers, and particularly among fans. But yeah, it just kind of comes and goes here.
The fact that Tony doesn't try to do anything about it.
Nope.
Just, oh, it happened. A little disappointing. And then we get another mention of that Project Firepower below with Edwin Cord again. And then, yet again there at the end, we get the West Coast Avengers back, and this time they kick Iron Man out of the Avengers. which wasn't too surprising. That was, I think, coming for a few issues, and with the firing of Iron Man, this is just kind of another spin on that.
Yeah. Well, the fact that he's essentially a fugitive? Is that the right word here?
Yeah, kinda.
I mean, if the State Department calls you a traitor, man without a country, I don't know how else to phrase that.
Yet, they let him walk out.
Yes.
So, definitely a bit of a gray area there. It was interesting. I think they're, again, trying to get Tony to hit rock bottom just because, well, that's a good story and such. And again, they're telling some fun stuff and quite a bit's happening, and this is definitely changing his status quo significantly. I almost, if the book had been named anything else, would have expected him to don a new identity other than Iron Man coming out of this arc.
Yeah, I can certainly see that.
So with the next issue, this is where the whole Project Firepower stuff kicks into high gear. They're training this guy with Jack Taggart to go take on Iron Man.
Yep.
And it looks like it's kind of a tank version of an Iron Man armor.
Yeah, definitely heavily armored and somewhat of a mobile artillery platform as well, more so than Iron Man traditionally is.
It's almost like a beta version of what you might expect for like a War Machine armor.
Yeah.
Because that thing has just got stuff all over it with rockets, and it looks much more like a walking tank than Iron Man does.
Yep.
And it was, you know, interesting to see him go up against that. I mean, it's a new suit of armor or whatnot, but it's the same sort of threat that he'd been worried about the whole time. And this was the issue where they finally deal with, okay, you've got the tech, but what are you going to do about the designs and all of that stuff out there?
Mm-hmm.
And they found an interesting approach to dealing with that. Obviously an ineffective one, given that we had Armor Wars a few times after this, and that Iron Man tech seems to have spread across the globe yet again over the years. So, but that's one of those things that once the genie's out of the bottle, it's hard to put back in.
Yeah, it's, you know, and again, it's interesting how some of it's dealt with and some of it isn't.
Mm-hmm.
Like, well, they're concerned about the fatalities, but, well, how would this work in, like, a populated area? And then the next time he's taking on tanks and fighter jets in a, you know what I mean? It's weird.
That doesn't seem like the kind of ordinance that would have any sort of lack of collateral damage. You know what I mean?
Exactly. And again, on a deserted battlefield with nothing but tanks and fighter jets, fine. But literally just the page before, they're talking about, you know, what it would be in an urban area or in a populated area. It's weird.
Yeah. Well, it comes down to, is it your populated area or the enemy's?
Yeah.
And I suppose people might have a different feeling depending which side it was on or something. But yeah, it definitely has an aspect of overkill to that armor. And I think Tony picked up on that, given the helicopter he's flying out to watch the festivities in has a complete med bay with lots of, you know, surplus blood and enough to patch him up no matter how badly he gets banged up. That just felt like a bit of a defeatist attitude for Tony, because I think in most cases Tony would have just built better armor to take with him. But I think that was also to set up the end of the issue, of course.
Well, and then I guess the question is, this satellite gift research station thing,
mm-hmm.
Do you know if this ever existed before this? Or was it introduced here? Had it actually been set up previously? Do you have a clue?
I think it had been set up because Tony had, matter of fact, I think they even referenced the Iron Man 215 or whatever.
Mm.
He had
a
satellite up there, and it got either infested with, I think they mentioned a plague here or something like that.
Yeah.
It was something that he couldn't use, but didn't want to mothball or explode either.
Yeah, you're right. It does say 215. I just missed that sometime.
Yeah, yeah. No, I remember, because it might have even been this that had Tony and Rhodey out in space. Coming back from that is what led to Rhodey stop being Iron Man. I don't remember if that was tied to this specific satellite or not, but I know it was a problem with re-entry that kind of spooked Rhodey out of the armor for quite some time. Because it's funny, at this point, even though Rhodey just about a year prior had been Iron Man, you know, at this point, he's just flying Tony around on, you know, a jet, a helicopter, or what have you, and that's his job these days, and he's reasonably happy with it. But I definitely took it from this fight that Tony was totally outclassed by this firepower armor.
Well, yes.
And it definitely ended with a bang, but that was one that it's like, okay, you know he's not dead.
Well, okay. To me, though, this was totally fair, because, of course, he's not dead, but they didn't even pretend he was. It was set up from the start.
It was set up from the start. They definitely played fair, and there was an obvious point of, okay, this is how they're faking the death.
Well, and I don't know if faking the death's the right word, or using it as a decoy to escape, you know, but when Rhodey kind of takes him and takes the helmet off and starts working on him on the med bay, at that point you realize this has to be a decoy.
I think it was playing fair, but trying to get people to think Tony was dead, the okay. readers included.
Okay. I guess I just never, I just realized there, yeah, Tony couldn't have been in there, but okay.
Yeah, but I think there are going to be some people who would have thought he was.
Fair enough.
Again, I think they played fair.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, if he hadn't stopped by the helicopter and had the, you know, we've got to deal with this or whatever.
Yeah.
It would have been a cheat the next issue.
Yes.
The fact that Tony's on the cover of the next issue is a little bit of a giveaway, too, of course.
Well, yes. And looking much better than he has in a few issues.
Yeah, yeah. I did find the cameos on the flipping channels in the front of the TV and stuff on the first page. It's kind of funny.
Yes.
A little bit of time had clearly elapsed since the end of the last issue, and everyone thinking that Iron Man is dead is just, it's good for Tony all the way around. And giving the how they did it type thing. Again, they played fair, so it didn't feel like a retcon or anything.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't know. I just, it felt like to me, the first issue was pretty clear that that's the way it had been done. And that, it was even when I was reading this, I'm like, why are they telling this? But as you point out, maybe that wasn't as obvious to all readers.
I don't think it was, but it was there to be had. So again, they played fair, and that's all I can ask.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that Tony spends some time putting together some new armor, again, not too surprising. Under the column of things that read a little differently now than they would have at the time, when Tony goes back to Stark Enterprises and the PR person's like, you know, as head of public relations, Mr. Stark, might I suggest a new corporate spokesperson? Someone a bit less controversial than Iron Man? Why don't I contact Bill Cosby's agent? Which at the time, yep, definitely would have been less controversial. A few decades later, not so much. Just kind of funny. Again, things like that, the Trump Tower cameo and stuff. Well, and again, one or two of the cameos that we just couldn't identify. It's funny how things read differently, you know, decades later.
Yeah, I guess.
I did think the way that this guy, Edwin Cord, was bullying companies with the firepower armor,
mm-hmm.
not the least bit subtle.
No, not particularly creative, but it's comics, it's, you know, not everything is the most complex storytelling.
No, but I'm trying to figure out how the firepower armor got into that part of the high rise to go crashing through the doors like that,
mm-hmm.
and just how tall that damn thing is. It feels larger here than it had in previous issues.
Okay, I can totally see that. It was giant.
Yeah. Well, it's almost probably on par or larger than the Ironmonger armor and such, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it is what it's a walking tank. It is what it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, you got to have room for all that armament, so yeah.
Yes.
But it was interesting how the captions imply it takes Tony a while to build up the new armor. I forget if they mentioned, but it seemed like it was weeks.
I don't know if they do mention.
In the weeks that follow.
No, there it is. Yep.
Yeah. But again, this whole home lab stuff, again, very much what we'd seen later in the movies.
No, absolutely, yep.
And he's building in safeguards, so it can't get stolen this time, you know. Be nice if that would work, but, you know, worth trying. I always like the issues when, you know, we get these kinds of montages of him building up the new armor and learning what it can do and stuff like that. It's just fun. At some point, they're going to do an Iron Man TV show. Maybe, you know, 20, 30 years from now. But that would be something that'd be a fun part of, you know, every season or some such. Of like, okay, he's gotten his butt kicked. He's got to go build some new armor to, you know, get back at it. Let's see how that plays out. So, because at that point, they'd probably be able to do a lot of the effects and whatnot on a TV budget, more so than they can now. But yeah, so I thought it was fun. I generally liked the look of the new armor. And then seeing him go up against firepower that had so trounced his previous armor, fun to see how this one has new bells and whistles and what it can do.
Yeah. Yeah, in some ways, this issue was kind of just a big giant fight scene, and in the splash page with the new armor might be the only big splash page like this we've seen in any of these issues.
Yeah, I mean, we sometimes get one on the first page, you know, beginning or whatever, yeah, to set some stuff up. But yeah, this is, I think, the splash page of the arc.
Yeah.
And you know somebody's got that hanging on their wall.
Probably.
If not, they should. Right. It would be interesting to see a compilation of all of these kinds of reveal shots of his armor over the decades.
Mm-hmm.
Be fun.
Yeah. And, you know, so now you've just kind of set up. I don't want to say we're through, but this felt like it could have been an end. Clearly it wasn't, but it felt like it could have been.
I think it was the end.
Okay.
Stark Wars Saga brought to you by.
Yep.
And the next one was an epilogue.
Fair enough.
And I took this as the end of the story.
Okay.
And I thought it was a good story. Again, I was expecting to see a few more villains and stuff like that than we got, but I was happy with what we got.
Yeah, I was too. Again, that first page set up, I wondered, is he really going to go meet Victor and argue that he stole the tag? And, you know, we ended up never seeing that, so.
I would have liked to have seen that, because the way I see that playing out is he goes charging in there, he asks, Doom says no. And Tony's like, well, yeah, I just had to ask. And it's like, okay, I'm ready to fly off now, kind of a thing.
Yeah.
You know. Of course, it would have been funny if at that point, if Victor had turned the question on him, and it's like, are you using mine? But yeah. I thought up until this point, it was a good arc. And then we got that next issue, 232, which was an epilogue. And the whole thing was just a nightmare he was having due to the guilt of his actions during the arc.
There's some really cool art. There's some really vibrant colors. It's awesome in some ways for those things. Is it relevant to the story? Not really.
I just didn't care for it. And yeah, maybe I'm just not a huge Barry Windsor Smith fan. I mean, he's a terrific artist.
Yeah.
But this isn't the armor we'd just seen Tony in, so that was a little off-putting. And the fact that it's all Nightmare sequence, and without even Nightmare the character showing up, and so much of it was told through captions, it just, and tonally, it was so different than what we'd just been getting.
Yes. No, it was, yeah, it was an artist issue. It was a nightmare. Yeah, again, not really relevant to the existing story exactly.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't bad. It just wasn't for me.
Yeah. Some of the arts and some of the coloring choices, though, I think are just phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Barry Windsor Smith is, you know, one of the all-time greats. It's kind of hard to dislike it as an old-time art fan.
He certainly knows how to tell a story. There's no two ways about that. I just, yeah. I don't care for the style.
Fair enough. Yeah, I can see that.
But I respect it.
Yeah. And it's actually interesting seeing Layton ink it. I think it's very different than what you would normally think of as classic Barry Windsor Smith.
Mm-hmm.
Also, very late in his career.
Yeah, yeah. I did find it interesting through the main part of the arc that Layton was credited with the plots and finishes. Michelini with the plot and script, and Mark D. Bright for breakdowns.
Yep.
I would have it just seems odd having somebody else do the breakdowns than one of the guys working on the plot.
Well, and what's weird is there's still an inker, so I'm not sure exactly what that position was.
Well, typically the breakdown is the one who's essentially doing either the thumbnails or that kind of a thing.
Yeah, I understand in theory what it is. Yes.
Did they have an inker listed for those other issues?
I believe they did. Maybe if they didn't, it makes more sense.
I don't think they did, because I think that's what Layton was kind of doing, kinda is finishing doing the pencils and
yes,
doing which the inks.
Which is what you'd expect. Oh, okay, I guess they know. Okay, that makes more sense. Okay.
They got a letterer and a colorist.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, fair enough. Okay. So yeah, Layton had been inking the whole time, so yeah. And he was co-plotting, I guess you want to call it.
Yeah.
Yeah, very Marvel method, what you'd expect kind of at the time.
Yeah, again, I just typically when I see kind of the plot credit getting split between a writer and artist, that's usually the artist that's doing kind of the breakdown type stuff, if not the finished pencils.
Yeah.
So having somebody else who's taking the plot they worked on and figuring out how it fits on the page and such, just kind of interesting.
It is an interesting, yeah.
It worked, so.
Yeah. But yeah, I don't think there's anything relevant to the story to talk about in this issue.
No, I don't think so. It's just a good end cap and kind of a breather before they started up the next arc. It was interesting because, to your point on that one splash of the armor and stuff, we didn't get many splash pages, zero double page splashes.
Yeah, I don't think there's a double page splash in any of these issues.
And there was just a ton that happened in the span of these 7 or 8 issues, depending if you count the last.
This could have been several years worth of stories in modern style.
Mm-hmm. Well, and having grown up on this era of storytelling, that's part of why I get a little, I don't say impatient or whatever, but it feels like not as much is happening with modern stories, because they're a lot more leisurely about it.
Yeah.
And that's not to say modern stories are bad. There's some current ones that I think are excellent. But you look at a year or two's worth of story arcs, or of issues these days, and maybe you get 3 or 4 arcs, whereas you look back at, you know, a 2-year period, you know, from like the 80s or something, and where their characters start and where they end over a 2-year period, there's a lot that's happened.
Well, yeah, in a lot of this late 70s, early 80s Marvel, I'm reading for the first time in the last 5-6 years through the Epic Collections, and those, mm-hmm. for the most part, are 1 year. And it's interesting, they usually have a title and they try to highlight a particular arc slash group of issues. And it's amazing how often you go, oh, you know, I'm interested in this, you know, whatever, Stark Wars. In this case, it was actually pretty lengthy. But a lot of them, it's, oh, that's just 2 of like the 14 issues in this book.
Yeah.
And a lot happens, both to set up and change the character, sometimes before and after kind of that focal main story.
Well, I think it's also why this era of comics is more challenging to collect into trade, because the arcs are of different lengths and threads continue from story to story to story, issue to issue to issue. So there's not always a, well, yeah, this is the obvious spot where you'd break, you know, from one trade to the next or something.
Yeah.
So I definitely think Marvel putting out the Epic Collection is just a brilliant idea. And at some point, you know, they'll have their entire library of content available in that, hopefully.
Well, and I'm glad they're beginning to reprint and keep some of them in stock. Some of the early ones and some of the more offbeat ones were getting hard to find, I know. You know, I've seen reprints and things happen, so that's kind of nice as well.
Yeah.
They're trying to keep them in print.
And I can see the challenge of that, given how extensive their library of material to keep in print is. But the Epic Collection is definitely something I would prioritize over other things.
Well, other than modern trades.
Well, I'm sure there was a trade of just the Stark Wars stuff. But if I had to choose between reprinting that or reprinting the Epic, I'd reprint the Epic.
At this point, definitely, yeah.
So, but yeah, I like this era of Iron Man. It's got a lot of fun stuff. I like this era of Marvel just because of all the cross-continuity. You know, things tying in from here to the Captain America storyline, to the West Coast Avengers, on up and down and such.
Yep.
It's fun.
It is. These were all great stories, yeah.
So, cool. Anything else?
I think I'm good.
Cool. The October previews came out on September 29th, and the deadline for preview spotlight number 167 is the morning of Saturday, October 9th. Recording clips for the preview spotlight episodes is easy, and we've got an open submission policy for these episodes. Please send in clips to support the comics you love as often as you can. If you'd like to get email reminders for the preview spotlight episodes, you can join the emailing list on the main page of the comicbookpage.com website. The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.